So I just want to read this little piece that Henry emailed me. Henry got this from Fred when he asked Fred about himself. So, you know, Henry's saying, I'm going to introduce you. Tell me about yourself. So Fred says, we were here, more or less, here being Gloucester, 1982 to 1989, and then 1998 to 2005. During that second stretch, I did lead a writer's group of 8 to 10 women in the living room. Smart local women, good writers. I urged, pretended to know things. Mostly cared as hard as I could about their work, which may be the one teachable thing anyhow. Sunday nights, nice times. That bond in the work and in the generous attention to one another's voices, a fruitful aspect of love. That's what Fred Dillon says when you ask him about himself. I was one of the women in his living room, and I'm so glad that I was there. I'm so happy to know him and his lovely wife. Taking a picture. And we welcome you back to Cape Ann. And when are you moving back here? Because we miss you. Yeah. Fred Dillon is going to read from his fabulous new novel, Beauty.
Yeah, I see people back by the bar. How I wish I were there. I'm glad to be here, and when I'm done, Leslie will come up, and she's an actress, and she's a clever one in the family, and she'll answer questions that you may that you may have. I am glad to be in Gloucester, and I'm not going to go on about it, or I'll get choked up, and then it'll be embarrassing for everybody. I'm going to just read, and I'm going to read 10 minutes max. And I'm just going to start at the beginning. Here we are in Gloucester, so of course the beginning begins in Wisconsin and then New York, so wouldn't you know? The rest of it I can't figure, and here's a page with nothing on it but one line. It says, already choked up. It says, how much longer have we got? To Leslie, who begins me and ends me and is joy between. But that's not even part of the book. Here we go, first chapter. Yeah. The first chapter is called Battle Bay, and it reads like this. It could have been a factory anywhere. Carol McLean had been shutting places down for that long, and after all these years, each place hurt more than the last. The good news was that after two more burials, this one and the next, she would finally get her own company, which was everything she could want. Today was the Battle Bay Pulp and Paper Mill in northern Wisconsin, and after a breath, she went into the lunchroom to deliver her news. She had come expecting to introduce herself and finish this hardest part of things in a couple minutes. Instead, she pulled a folding chair to the wall behind the men. They couldn't have numbered more than 40, and they didn't begin to fill this lunchroom that had once served several shifts. At the other end of the room, the owner stood on another folding chair. He wasn't dressed much differently than his men, and he looked at them as if he knew them. There was nothing of practical value, he could say, but he had wanted to talk to these last few, which didn't happen all the time, and Carol had thought it was a sympathetic gesture. Then he began with, here we are, and was already choked up. He cared about his men, but maybe he cared too much. Carol sat forward in her chair. She was already alert in the usual ways once you came through the door. If you didn't project authority, you knew it, and the men knew it, and that made everything worse for everybody. She also reached in her pocket to check that her phone was off. When it came time for her to say what she had to say, the men should know that they were all that was on her mind. The owner said, most of you knew my father, but my grandfather, the men shifted in their chairs, the owner said, with your skills and dedication, and made something like a sob. Carol got up. The owner said, excuse me, it's an emotional day. those of you still here, we've known one another, worked together for a long time. Carol walked to the front of the room. The owner said in a sorrowful whisper, I let you down. Carol reached him and said, why don't you let me take over? He looked confused and she held up a hand to help him off his chair. He took her hand and stepped down and walked to the door, and Carol climbed up on the chair in his place. She said to the men, this is it. You knew it was coming. I wish I could say there might be an emergency room deal with Baxter Bloom, but there won't. These old buildings will be teardowns when we get what we can get for what's inside. Your owner has promised you and set aside 2 weeks' pay. I'll make sure that you receive it. If you have any problems, you can find me in the offices. They got up, and when they were up, they stood. They were the oldest and the last, and they just didn't want to leave yet. Page three, it's... Every man she could, she looked in the eye. Her father had been a machinist for a supplier outside Detroit. He had died at his bench because that was who he was and what he did, and finally, all he had beside his four packs a day. To the men here, Carol said, I'm sorry, and she meant it. In her heart, she also said it to her father. Really, I'm a guy who went to boarding school, really. It was out of bounds for Carol to tell herself that she hurt when she closed places down and fired people, but she did, and it felt as if all of the closings and firings had piled up on top of her. One more, and she'd be out from underneath them. Instead of an undertaker, she'd be a CEO. All right, she'd be a backdoor CEO in some pocket-sized outfit, nothing the equity partners at Baxter Bloom could ever dream of wanting, but Carol had always dreamed it. For now, she still faced the men of Battle Bay. She said, there's information on the sheets outside and your union has material for you. She nodded to them and said, good luck. A few at first and then all of them turned and left, and Carol got down from her chair. When she reached in her pants pocket to turn on her cell, it vibrated. Baxter. Neither Baxter nor Bloom nor any of the rest of them ever went near a plant floor with bad news. They would not have admitted it, but Carol could tell they were frightened of the working men they put out of work. Carol came from working men and wasn't frightened. After coming up as a parts salesman for the best motor company, she had what once seemed like the best job she'd ever get as the lowest of Baxter Bloom's executives. Baxter's joke was to ask how many bodyguards she needed each time she told men their jobs were history. Was it a 5-bodyguard event? 5 was the high. She played along because behind the joke, Carol believed Baxter respected what she did, delivering the news and then the slog of disposal that came afterward. Not that there really were bodyguards today or most days, though in a few places she had gotten people to watch her car for the duration. Today, she said quickly before Baxter could get into his banter, the next company after this is the last. As she spoke, Carol remembered the heartbreak in the owner's face and the emptiness in the faces of the men. Baxter said, I'm thinking 4 bodyguards. I can feel it from here. There was laughter in his background. Carol said, Baxter, you told me that after my next corporate burial, I'm done as an undertaker. 5? Tell me you don't need 5 bodyguards. Do I need to make calls for your safety? 1 more company to bury, and then I get my own company to run. I need to hear you promise me that again. Okay, Carol, okay, the next company is the last one you bury. And then I get my own company to run. The gears are already turning, Carol, cross my heart. She said, I broke the news today without any bodyguards, but you, Baxter, would have wanted 5. Before she hung up, she heard someone say through the laughter, nobody screws with the beast. Carol pocketed the phone and took a breath and moved on. I have one more page here, new chapter called New York. When Baxter saw Carol McLean walk past his door with a journal under her arm, he was not happy. Fortunately, he was on the other side of his office, so she didn't see him. Baxter had bad news for Carol, and he didn't want to break it now, and he hadn't thought he'd have to. Truth be told, he couldn't. Carol was supposed to be on her way up the coast to bury a little fish processing outfit, after which he'd tell her. Baxter watched her stride down the hallway. She was wearing a skirt instead of pants and high heels that weren't remotely high, but were a statement for Carol just the same. Baxter thought he knew what the statement was. She'd come in today to make sure that after this next burial, she would be getting her company. She wasn't going to say so outright, he hoped. She wouldn't want to press so hard he'd reconsider. Baxter himself wouldn't say what he had to say either. She looked good, relatively speaking. Whether she was dressed up or not, though, Baxter had always found her a mystifying presence. Really, she was nothing but bones and angles and parchment white skin, so thin you could see through her. She was also, what, 6'1", but from a generation of women who didn't want to be tall, which was why she almost never wore high heels. The tall ones now wore heels that put them most of the way to the ceiling, which Baxter sometimes appreciated and sometimes didn't. Anyhow, Carol was flat-chested along with everything else, not that Baxter stared at his employees. But what she did have was the great red hair she'd managed to keep all these years. That and posture. She wasn't just erect. Despite her natural and professional courtesy, she had always held her shoulders back like a wrong side of the tracks tough girl. Almost done. Baxter would never entirely understand it, but taken as a whole, Carol possessed what his mother had always wished he had, character. I'm rooting for her, page 6. Baxter liked Carol for it. What's more, he'd known she was ready to run her own company for years now, and that made everything harder. He wished to hell she hadn't come in today, dressed up, for Christ's sake. Enough. And the rest of it is at least as good. Should read, I should. You know, I thought everybody would be rushing for the bar here. This will be fun for you. I'll be weeping all the way through. This is something called From Now On, and we're well into the book, and there's a time when I think you get a sense of this, that she's going to take over this plant and make a success of it or not. And as soon as she connected with Parks at the new plant, Carol put on a hair bag. There's been a new plant that's been built, and the fat boys who built it used to run the old plant. They've run money through it to themselves, brand new turnkey plant. Nobody works there anymore, hardly, and that's part of what she's supposed to bury. But the old plant, she's been to see it. It's looks you've still got it here for a little while longer. The old bird's eye plant. And did you ever go in that when Bill Stride was running Good Harbor Filet? Yikes! What a place, Dickensian. It was a great, probably still all in there anyway. But they could turn it on and make a fish stick if you needed, as the guy told her. As soon as she connected with Parks, and Parks is the one good guy among the executives that she keeps on, as soon as she connected with Parks at the new plant, Carol put on a hair bag and a smock and shoe covers. She brought all the office staff down onto the floor. Annette was still confused about electricity usage in the old plant, and Carol said, okay, let's get on it, and put it out of her mind. That'll come into play at another time. And Annette is going to be the financial officer after we've gotten rid of the bad guy. She knew she'd want to stand on something, but she hadn't planned that out. She looked around at the women who were the regular plant laborers. 20 people in this plant, has parking for 100, should be running 3 shifts. She looked as many in the eye as she could, and she nodded and smiled without pretending to be friends. She wanted to appear as if she were in charge, as if it didn't matter what they thought of her. She had been on plant floors before them, but this time was different. She stood up straight and let the men look in, let the women look into her, and she hoped they could see she understood what plant work meant. She hoped they could see she was honest and capable of running a company. She hoped they could see she was nervous, but that she was steady despite being nervous, unlike your reader. She stood among them and told all of the office staff, including Parks and Annette, was down and had mingled. In her father's plant, almost all the places she shut down, the people in the offices were apart, upstairs mostly. So the upstairs was mostly the enemy. Her father called it the upstairs and hated and worshipped it. In the working women's faces here today, Carol saw envy, judgment, curiosity, eagerness for a deal, and readiness to do work. She saw kindness and anxiousness and readiness to laugh. She saw assertion and reticence. She saw plain women and strong women. Really, just I need help up here. And women who had been pretty and pretty girls who were tough. She saw a lot of reluctance to hope. All these women think they're out of a job. She looked down at a concrete floor that was so new the gray floor paint still had its gloss. She saw her massive feet in the shoe cover she had on great green hooves. There had been a face that had looked able to laugh, and Carol tried to remember which one. She looked up and searched the faces again and found that face, and she engaged those eyes. She lifted one foot. She looked at her raised foot, the giant hoof, and looked again at the eyes that might laugh. She imagined Baxter on the floor, which would have been a first for him, and not a happy one. She looked at her hoof again and stood down on it, and then hopped da-dum, da-dum, from hoof to hoof. She hopped like a kid pretending to ride a horse. She made just the gesture of her hands holding the reins. It took no more than an instant, but everyone saw. I love this woman. In an instant that seemed an hour and made firing people seem a walk in the park. And she heard Baxter's voice in her head saying, "What the hell are you doing?" The woman made a low chuckle. Carol heard that and made one more da-dum, da-dum, with her hands pulling on the reins now and her eyes on her horse, and leaning back to stop, the chuckle became a laugh. Then Carol looked up at the woman who was laughing and laughed herself. God, how much longer? They looked at each other and it was funny and they laughed out loud. Now she could look around at all of the other faces again and they laughed. They laughed at Carol and they laughed with her. They laughed wondering what was going on, but they laughed. She stood in her blue suit and her smock and her hair bag and her shoe covers full of news, and Baxter said, "All right, screw me." She let go of her horse and relaxed from the laughter and let everyone else relax. She walked to the first of the lines. And the women led her through, and she said to no one in particular, "Can I stand here on a part of the line?" The line was a black belt on rollers with its stainless sheathing. She put her hands on the edge and looked around while I break the belt. Someone pushed through to spread a clean cloth over the edge and the belt. One of the Asian women said, another woman said, "I'll get a stepladder." Carol said, "I'm okay," and she reached under her smock and hitched her pants and swung a knee up. She could still climb onto something she wanted to climb onto. She didn't worry about what she looked like. She was who she was. This is why it took so long to write this book. Is it really? She was who she was, and this was what she wanted to do and how she wanted to do it. And she didn't give a shit about Baxter. All right. There were other hands on her already, steadying her, some actually pushing her to help her up. She said thank you without looking back. She put her weight on her own hands, got one foot underneath her, and then the other. She gathered her balance as much on the edging as could be, and she stood. She turned around to face them all, and the Asian woman who had brought the cloth looked up at her and said, "Phew," with a gasp of breath as if she'd had to climb up herself. There was enough quiet that the "phew" sounded out. Carol said, "Phew," and there was another general laugh. Then she said, "Take a look around," and she looked around herself at the fat boy's new and too shiny plant. The walls were as glossy as the floor, almost everything else but the belts, and there was a lot of everything else was stainless. There was some signage and some OSHA cautions in small red squares. There were a few yellow components beneath what must have been the ovens. There were lines of orange hosing. There were other stairs. There were gates and double doors for equipment. There were tracks to and from the freezers. There was a small isolated line in its own alcove that she knew was for experimental products, though she was sure that the fat boys had never done or imagined doing any experiments. Overhead, weaving under and through brand new iron roof trusses painted a nice Rust-Oleum orange, were the tin and stainless ducts and vents and fans. It was the opposite of the old plant. It was all white walls and chrome next to her bent Mustang. She liked her Mustang. She was a car girl. And she liked her old plant. The people before her were almost out now, were quiet. She said, "It's a pretty place." It was quiet, and she said, "You won't work again in a place as pretty as this." Now the quiet was listening in a different way. She said, "From here on out, it gets ugly." Nobody was about to laugh now, and she didn't smile. She said it and let it sit. All of the faces listened, and she listened with them. She looked once more around the fat boy's meal ticket, and she heard a few feet shuffle in restlessness. She said, "From now on," the shuffling stopped, and she said, "Come on, Carol." She said, "From now on, we're going to be working in the old plant." Enough.